Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. My name is Joseph Earp.
I'm Dan Dixon.
And we're here to talk about part two of Meet Joe Black.
We're talking about Meet Joe Black again. I guess there aren't two films. There's not a Meet Joe Black universe.
Well, though, to be honest, when you rented this film from Video Easy in the late 90s, it came on two VHS tapes. Same thing if you wanted to get Titanic. You could get Titanic on two VHS tapes in one of those big old clunky VHS jewel cases. Godfather trilogy on VHS. Am I showing my age? You're as old as me, Dan. Surely you remember.
No, they must have updated VHS technology between 1997 and 2002, because I remember getting The Fellowship of the Ring on one VHS tape, and that's longer than Meet Joe Black.
Is that true? Is The Fellowship of the Ring longer than Meet Joe Black?
It's more than 3 hours, and Meet Joe Black is just over 3 hours.
And you know what?
Want me to check?
Tight as a drum. Yeah, check for me.
Fellowship of the Ring, absolutely.
Meet Joe Black, absolutely tight as a drum. You don't think so? It doesn't lag for a second.
I guess it depends what you mean by lag.
There's always something interesting going on.
That is true. I was thinking, yeah, Fellowship of the Ring's 3 hours 28.
Is it
And that's
really?
The theatrical cut. The extended is 208 minutes.
Fucking hell. Fellowship of the Ring.
I saw that...
How many times at the cinema?
9 times at the cinema. 2001, baby.
It's an.
I was probably sad, I imagine, looking back. That's probably why that happened.
Fellowship is, I mean, we've talked about it so many times, but it's an unbelievable film. Those films are magic.
Yeah.
The way that they get through plot, character development, establishing world, there's no other film like that where you are so intimately connected to the characters. You don't feel like you're just being force-fed plot extremely quickly. You feel like you have moments to ruminate and hang out with your friends, the Fellowship. It's miraculous.
There's so many distinctly, and I mean, I guess it's because I saw it 9 times, but distinctly memorable sequences as well. Even in the 2000 Return of the King, which I saw less, there's so many extraordinary character relationships. And it's like, I feel like that the way I feel about The West Wing or Buffy or long, long series, hundreds of hours of series of television that I watched in my kind of teens. Fellowship manages to establish that in 3 hours.
I had this internal struggle with myself about this recently because I watch so many films. Last year I watched 365 films across the year. I haven't been able to keep up with that pace this year. But I was, because often when I'm trying to go to sleep, I will go through Letterboxd as a calming thing to get me to sleep. And I was looking through the films that I watched last year. And I just had this process of going, I don't remember that film. I don't remember anything that happens in that film. I don't remember anything that happens in that film. And it started to freak me out that maybe there's something about the pace at which I'm consuming films that they just slip in and out of my head. But I think a great film imprints it upon yourself on first viewing. Because I thought about stuff that I haven't seen many times, but I could tell you almost every scene. For instance, the film I weirdly thought about is First Reformed, which I adore, but have seen maybe twice. And I think I could tell you almost every beat in that film. Whereas stuff that I saw 2 weeks ago, I've got no fucking idea what happens in.
It's interesting that you say that, because over this morning, I finished Meet Joe Black this morning, and I've been kind of swinging wildly back and forth about how I feel about Meet Joe Black. And how that might kind of represent how I feel about cinema in general, as opposed to you specifically, I think, or our differing perspectives of cinema. Because what you say about films imprinting on you is interesting, because I don't feel like I'm going to forget Meet Joe Black anytime soon, whereas I feel I could get The Devil's Own, Sleepers, a bunch of those types of films we've watched recently, confused within 2 or 3 months. But Meet Joe Black, I'm not going to forget, definitely, if that's a measure of quality, which I'm not sure it is, but maybe it is.
I'm convinced it's a measure of quality. There can certainly be films that you only remember very key moments from, but that means that those moments are extraordinarily good. The example I always think about is there's this weirdo film called The Door in the Floor. Have you heard about that film?
I think I have. Maybe from you.
Yeah, nobody really remembers that film. It's based on the first half of the John Irving novel, A Widow for 1 Year, but it basically just stops literally halfway through. There's no sequel. It just takes the first part of the book as being its substantive narrative drive. It's about a children's book illustrator who writes these books about a mysterious door in the floor who loses both of his sons in a car accident and hires an intern to work with him and the intern sleeps with his wife, and it's all very ripe Irving melodrama. And the film is okay. And then at the end, you have this kind of emotional climax. And then you see the illustrator, who's played by Jeff Bridges, playing squash in his decked out squash court. He finishes playing squash, leans down against the wall, and then he reaches forward, fiddles with the floor, and opens something, and you see there's a trap door in his squash court, and he just gets up and climbs the ladder down the trap door, and the film ends. And I am convinced Jeff Bridges descending into this trapdoor that you've that's never been hinted at except for in the name of his children's books is one of the most transcendent images in like contemporary American cinema, even though the rest of the film is forgettable and not great and not particularly interesting.
Is there any other sense of surrealism in the film, or is that it? Or is that...
So that's the genius. It has been extremely by the numbers, almost TV movie like Irving Apple. You know what the fuck I was going to call it? Apple cider. Cider House Rules style, very straight melodrama.
Yeah.
And then he just descends down a trapdoor.
Insane. I mean, Jeff Bridges doing that also adds a wonderful texture. That's, I guess that links back to what I was thinking about Meet Joe Black as well, which is whether it's more or less than a sum of its parts. I think that one of the reasons I do not watch 365 movies a year is because I watch a film like this, it doesn't make me feel anything especially powerful. It doesn't seem to drive me towards kind of strong feelings about art in the way that I want from art necessarily. I'm perfectly happy to watch it, but it doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't stick with me or something. I think part of it is that films require so many people and so many elements, and there's so much of it that can go wrong, that a serviceable film is an incredibly difficult thing to create. And I see this as a serviceable film, and that is an extraordinary feat in terms of filmmaking, but I just don't know if I care.
I think it's so much better than a serviceable film. We have to deep dive into Meet Joe Black, Part 2, the final 90 minutes, which, I mean, I think we needed to talk about the insanity of the first half. The first half is where all these things happen. The car crash, patois, all of the things that people...
Although...
I know.
It's a comeback.
The return of the patois is Meet Joe Black, Part 2. All the things that people know from Meet Joe Black largely take place within the first 90 minutes. Because, I mean, we usually do an overview of the plot of the film that we're talking about. The second half of this film is essentially death in the body of Brad Pitt has sex with his love interest. We have to talk about that because I think it's the first really extended sex scene that we've ever seen from Brad Pitt, even though he's a sex object.
That hadn't occurred to me. I think that's true. It seems to know that as well.
Then the last hour of the film is this party, this rolling series of emotional crescendos.
And musical crescendos.
Yes, literal crescendos. The film just keeps upping its stakes as it resolves all of these narrative threads that it's been juggling for some time in what you might call a workmanlike manner, in that you can definitely sense the screenwriter going, right, that's the end of that thing, on to the next thing, that's the end of that thing. But the solutions to the problems are so insane, it has a magic pull to it, I genuinely believe. I think you should talk about your emotional journey watching the second half of this film, because if you didn't listen to the first half of this episode, Dan was maybe more positive than he realized when he was on a macro level. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
What was your experience of the second half?
Well, it's strange, right? Because watching this in two parts, it kind of feels like, in some ways, the experience of watching a serialized television show, which we talked about this being if it was to be made today. And so you have this sense of returning to the characters and having certain affections for some and like disdain for others, or just stronger feelings about them, having been away from them, returning to them. I think I respected Brad Pitt's performance more in the second half. I went back and forth on it, but I think there is something to be said for his vacancy. It kind of works, especially towards the end, or especially right at the end. It kind of pays off in somewhat. I really like Anthony Hopkins in this film. I really like Jeffrey Tambor in this film. I think Anthony Hopkins does incredible work in with what I maintain is, while structurally I could imagine conceding that the screenplay is, you know, structurally effective or effective in terms of characterization, but there are some god-awful lines in there. Just true trash. Like bad dialogue that is like tinier dialogue consistently that is very difficult. And Anthony Hopkins somehow is extraordinary with it. And again, Jeffrey Tambor, he's the heart and soul of this movie.
I knew you would. As I say, I've seen this film perhaps, this might be my fifth go around with Meet Joe Black. Every time I appreciate it more. But I had kind of forgotten, because for the rewatch for the first half, I stopped at where you stopped. And I had forgotten how much the second half of this film rehabilitates Quince, the Jeffrey Tambor character. He essentially becomes the emotional heart of the second half of the film. It's a very odd decision.
There's a wonderful scene where he's talking about the kind of nature of loving someone and being in a relationship. And he's also, like, he's just so funny. He's just got such wonderful comic timing and such a face.
We should try and do the five-sentence game with this second half. Would you like to take the reins?
At a board meeting, it is announced that the company is going to be taken away from Anthony Hopkins that he's worked to create, and Jeffrey Tambor has unwittingly played a key role in this. Brad Pitt sleeps with Susan and they fall in love with each other, nominally. That's two sentences, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're taking them down. No, I'm sorry, I was only half
watching. Dan's getting confused. Joe
got his fingers keeping a track of the thing. After fighting with Anthony Hopkins about being deaf and being in love with his daughter and threatening her to take her away ambiguously or ominously, there is a kind of reverse heel turn, I guess, where Pitt confronts the bad actor in the company that is threatening to take it away from Anthony Hopkins, revealing himself, to Anthony Hopkins' surprise, to be from the IRS. Pretending to be from the IRS and using this to remove the corporate threat to make kind of resolve Anthony Hopkins' corporate troubles and maintain his legacy. It was a long sentence, but it was one concept, well, basically. At Anthony Hopkins' birthday party, the big, massive lawn party out the front of a mansion, those were in M dashes, that was a subclause. Pitt, having had a discussion with Hopkins about what it would mean to be in a relationship with Susan, somehow reveals to Susan that he's deaf. Is this, does she realize, how does she know, sorry, David Foster Wallace footnote, how does she know?
We'll talk about that. Amazing scene, okay. Unbelievable scene.
I don't know if I was like distracted or something, but that was very baffling. Reveals to Susan that he's deaf and then goes to the edge of the party with Anthony Hopkins, where Anthony Hopkins kind of silently exits stage left, happy with his legacy. And then Pitt, in a move that I saw coming maybe half an hour before the end of the film, vacates his body to return to Madden Coffee Shop that was Brad Pitt. Susan seems a little disappointed and then, but melancholically embraces the possibility of falling in love with this man who flirted with her so nicely before being battered to death by two cars, and the credits roll.
Unbelievable.
Some long sentences.
Unbelievable film. You've highlighted some of the key things that we need to talk about that make this second half great.
We forgot the second patois, which works to kind of, as kind of a character development role for Brad Pitt in understanding people, I guess.
I'm pretty happy.
Could be cut without the film being.
I'm pretty happy to not return to discussions of patois in the second episode. Why don't we? Sorry.
It's just so striking.
Why don't we avoid the mistake that the film makes and just like never discuss problematic representations of patois ever again? We'll be one up over Martin Brest in this film. I need to take a sip of iced tea. My throat is a little tickly. I survive on iced tea. When I quit drinking, I just needed something. I don't like sweet things very much, and I needed something to just constantly break up the day and to something to imbibe regularly. So I make these big 2-liter pots of tea that I overbrew that taste extremely strange. Every time I give them to Dan in the good old pre-COVID days when he used to come over, I would feel a little bit like the Joaquin Phoenix character in The Master, making weirdo, like, brewed spirits that I was giving to you.
Something I will say about those mugs of tea is that always flavorful, often delicious, but always, like, a liter as well. Just enormous.
I have this here.
Big hard to finish, to be honest.
Glass mug of tea. I used to have two of these. I now have one of these because my body was kind of revolting against the amount of tea that I was imbibing. It does terrible things to your body and your emotional state if you over-caffeinate. I'm sure most people know this, but it was a learning curve for me. I think the things we need to talk about in order, little sketch preview. We need to talk about the Quince stuff. We need to talk about the sex scene, and we need to talk about the last 20 minutes of this film. And we need to do all this on the backdrop of me saying that about an hour before the credits roll in this film, I just start crying and don't really stop being re-prompted to cry throughout the entire of the hour. Every time I'm kind of done dabbing at my eyes, something else happens that prompts me to get teary.
That's so moving. That's very lovely, Joseph.
I am a very big crier at movies. Are you a crier?
I am, absolutely. I cannot remember what the context was, but I saw The Seventh Seal at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and I remember weeping for the last 20 minutes at such a level that I was extremely worried that people around me would, like, think something was going on.
That is but such I just a, couldn't contain it. Such a cold and inhuman film, Dan.
Utterly devastating. No, I cry quite a lot.
I do too. I definitely.
But that's the Seventh Seal. Seventh Seal is, I mean, that it's about death. It's about the kind of the majesty and unavoidability of death. Just utterly extraordinary.
As is Meet Joe Black. As is Meet Joe Black.
Yes. Actually, yeah, of course. Seventh Seal, a better film than Meet Joe Black. Definitely.
I love Bergman.
That's funny that I brought that up. That didn't occur to me.
I love Bergman, but I think they're about on par. I really do. No, I'm a sucker for crying. I'm even a sucker for crying at things that I don't necessarily morally approve of. That's how quick I am to tears. I can watch an advert and I can be kind of choked up by it.
Me too. Those weird, like, Telstra ads where all the families are driving to meet each other or whatever. Yeah. I hate that shit. Yeah. And I'll shed a tear.
I used to be so emotionally overwhelmed by sad things, and particularly seeing people cry is a really big one for me. If I'm watching a character on screen cry, it almost always prompts tears in me. This used to be such a problem that when I was younger that I would be haunted for days about things that I had seen that had really upset me. So from the age of about 6, I was a massive Wallace and Gromit fan. Do you like Wallace and Gromit?
I adored them. I watched those endlessly when I was a kid. I had them on I had the wrong trousers on VHS, at least.
I did too.
The penguin is upsetting. I was freaked out by that penguin.
I love Feathers McGraw. He reminds me very much of my dog, Ida. I think they have a lot of similarities. They look quite similar.
They do. Same face.
Same face.
Same eyes.
Exactly same eyes. Same shifty, kind of slightly silent what's going on here nature to both of them. I had them all on VHS tape, but I found it almost impossible to watch. Maybe first or second one is called A Grand Day Out.
That's the first one.
In it, Wallace and Gromit go to the moon, and when they're on the moon, they are approached by a ticket inspector robot that you have to put coins in. He's coin operated, and when he runs out of coin juice, he stops. And he's basically there to enforce the rules and laws of the moon. But we eventually discover he's obsessed with skiing. And he discovers some literature that Wallace and Gromit have brought with them that shows the Alps of Earth. And so he desperately decides that he wants to come back with them to Earth so he may pursue his skiing career. So the climax of the film is Wallace and Gromit misunderstanding the intentions of the robot, who they think is going to attack them, whereas all he's trying to do is get on this. I might be getting a little bit emotionally raw as I retell this now. He just wants to go back to Earth so he can ski, and they don't understand, and they blast off without him, and there's this shot of him sitting. He's been holding the sides of the ship, and they blast off, and there's a shot of him lying on the surface of the moon holding these two bits of metal in his hands. And as a kid I just bawled, and not only did I cry, it haunted me for such a long time, the idea that he just wanted to go to the fucking Alps and they didn't understand, and a fundamental breakdown in communication stopped him from living his dreams.
But isn't the final shot him skiing on the moon, right?
He skis on the moon.
The rocket parts.
The bits of metal that he's been blown off, yeah. He then uses them as ski poles, but it feels like I'm being thrown a bone a little bit. I think we all know in an ideal world he would be skiing on the Alps, and we're all settling for less a little bit, as happy as he might seem.
Sure.
I don't know what it is. Just stuff like that hurts me terribly. It's very similar. Did you see Iron Giant when you were a kid?
I've never seen that, no. I remember crying because someone on play school was singing a song about the wind, and Mum said, oh, that's melancholy. And that's when I learned the word melancholy. I specifically remember that, like that feeling you're feeling, because it's not actually, like, the wind isn't sad, but this song is slow. I remember being so upset by it. from Mum was like, that's what melancholy is. So I'll always associate the word melancholy with this stupid song about the wind on play school.
So it was the song itself that had emotionally moved you first, and then your mother named it for you.
Exactly, yeah.
Brianna, who is in the background of the shot doing work, can you holler hello for the listeners of the Brad Pitt cast?
Hello!
She's hollering from across the other side of the room. What was it, Brianna? You watched some film as a kid about it.
Paulie. I was going to shout out. It was Paulie.
Brianna saw a film called Paulie as a kid, and there's a
That's
bit...
when he got his wings clipped and he couldn't fly anymore.
It's a film about a parrot, and they clip his wings and he can't fly anymore. Did you cry hysterically, Brianna?
Yeah.
It's these things that we are shown as children traumatize us. They genuinely do in I think sometimes a helpful way, particularly films about cruelty to animals and films that give animals agency, I think are genuinely useful. I mean, how many people did Babe make a vegetarian? It literally made James Cromwell, the lead actor of that film, a vegetarian. Did you know that? He was a meat eater before he was in Babe, and then he was like, I was just standing around all these incredibly intelligent and emotional pigs, and I could never eat meat again. And he would literally get arrested for protesting for Peter. My accent makes it sound like he's protesting for a man named Peter. I mean, he's protesting for the people against the, you know, whatever, people for the protection of animals. This film, you didn't feel teary at all? You didn't feel moved by the second half?
No. No, I'm sorry.
I start crying even... You alluded it, so let's... It's a good way to dovetail into it. Quince, who is a very empathetic character, realizes that he has unwillingly played a part in the deposition of Anthony Hopkins, who he cares about. And there's a scene where he's kind of guzzling red and white wine at the pre-party. Just disgusting. Can you imagine those sloshing around in your stomach? Awful. And he says to Pitt as Death, you know, what did I do? The level of hurt that he feels at this mistake is, I found so moving. That's where the border works start for me.
I guess it just feels so abstracted to me. Last week, we were talking about how this film seems to be a children's film with all the kids cut out, and just like the adult scenes that happen in the background. It just feels like so plotted. And I mean, I guess that's not tightly plotted, but just everything is so functional and self-aware. And it just, I'm finding this film more difficult to talk about than most of the films you've watched, and I do not know why. It seems to capture a particular feeling that just leaves me a little bit cold, and I wish it didn't, because I think I can recognize elements in there that seem human to me, but they just seem poorly rendered in a way that means they have no emotional impact on me.
Probably a good time to mention, I'm not sure if he's a listener of the show, I think he might be, Tristan, who is someone who's known to you, Dan, tweeted at us and pointed out that Tristan's father loves Meet Joe Black. It's one of Tristan's dad's favorite films. And more than that, Tristan's dad sees nothing out of the ordinary about this film. And you know what?
Fascinating.
I kind of feel sympathetic to the position of Tristan's dad.
Shout out to Tristan and his dad.
Yeah, I kind of, for the most part, reckon that this is a sturdy emotional drama. And by the last 40 minutes, I'm not really thinking about the wackadoo, patois, car crashes, death stuff.
I guess I would love to use a word that was not this snobbish, but it just feels unintelligent to me.
It
feels
care.
Like someone who has never thought deeply about emotional issues. Like, not that you have to have felt or thought deeply about emotional issues in order to communicate something interesting about emotions. It doesn't have to be shot through intellect, but it just doesn't, it's not innovating in ways I want it to innovate. I just want something intelligent. I don't see why I'm engaging with it otherwise.
Damn. No, it is intelligent. It's deeply emotionally intelligent. It does have, you say...
Is it?
Yes, Dan. It's about love. It's genuinely about love. Not intelligence as in I can tell you something extremely complicated that you would have to cognize. It's just deeply felt.
I don't need that. Okay, something deeply felt about emotionality. I don't care about it having to be articulated in a sophisticated way. That is totally fine. Does not need to be expressible in, like, traditionally conceived forms of intelligence at all. But then the last scene is this guy from a coffee shop she spent 6 minutes with. Her father has just died, and it's like, well, this is what I have. I'm going to be happy into the future. Like, that just is so insane. It doesn't even ring anything true
at all for me. For someone who so often talks about being generous to art, you are being very not generous to the ending of Meet Joe Black. What does she say? What's the actual exchange that she and the Pitt character say?
Something like, who knows what the future holds? Well, it'll come to it. Or what do we do next? It will come to us.
Yes. That is a deeply emotional, intelligent response that speaks to the things that you're worried about. I think it's such a beautiful final two lines. They're actually callbacks to lines that we've heard earlier in the film, Death Say.
Exchange. A lot of callbacks in the last 20 minutes.
It's just a lot of callbacks. The film definitely knows that you are basically seeing two people who have spent 6 promising minutes together walk off into the rest of their lives. Will those lives be lived together? I don't think that the film is heavy-handedly suggesting that the answer is yes. I think those two last lines are a hat tip to the fact that they're going, we'll muddle through this. And who knows how this will go for either of us. It'll come to us, for better and for worse. And maybe it won't work out. She has, as you say, just lost her father. I buy it.
It feels too saccharine for me.
I just think that's
offset. And I'm not against soapiness. I can buy into soapiness. I think, again, I want a kind of coherence of the world. And also, I don't hate it as much as I sound like I do. I'm just pushing back. It's fine. It does some really interesting and cute and fun things. It's just, I feel like I would be so uninterested to have a conversation with anyone in this, like, who made this film about the thinking behind this film. Like, I just would not care what they had to say.
You don't.
It would not be interesting.
That's an old Pitcast argument, though, because intentionality,
I don't care about intentionality. I just care about commitment, I think, to certain, to a set of concerns, like innovation, maybe strangeness, emotional depth, other things. Doesn't have to be all of them. But this film just doesn't seem committed to anything in a way that I'm interested in.
I just think this final hour, which is all set at the party and has this, you alluded to it a little bit before, it has this very stagey feel. I mean, you said Hopkins exits stage left. When Hopkins is reaped by death, which could be very horrible, or particularly in the 90s, I'm sure there was at least a meeting from the studio with notes that were like, Pitt should suck Hopkins' body with CGI through his mouth, or some extremely kind of explosive, wild scene.
Well, the voices early on, when he's like hearing these voices and having a heart attack, that's quite, or seeming to have some kind of like near-death event, that's quite like intense, but they don't do that at the end.
They literally wander off stage left. They walk into the gloom together and the Pitt character returns. And it's so oddly done. It's so theatrical. It feels like you've just stumbled into a different mode of telling this story. I don't feel like the ending is jarring. I feel like actually that surreality, that theatricality of the party is, dare I say it, expertly built up to. And I just slide right into it. I'm like the man in Under the Skin, Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin, the kind of Scottish punter following Scarlett Johansson till I'm up to my neck in black goo. I'm very similar.
That's definitely how you watch movies.
Yes. I'm just there. And, you know, that means that I can get these beautifully observed moments. You know, Pitt and Hopkins are kind of fighting and Pitt standing there watching the fireworks by himself. And it's emotionally overwhelming to me, that image of him standing there looking at
the fireworks. It seems like such a cliche. It seems like something I've seen before 1,000 times and has no new information associated with it.
I think my interest in cinema could be boiled down to things like somebody standing emotionally and watching fireworks.
Something that just occurred to me is we were talking about intentionality, talking about intelligence. Do I ever want to read a book by someone who I don't think is intelligent? Just no. Just absolutely not. Why would I want to see a movie by someone who I don't
but
think
is intelligent?
I certainly don't care about intentionality with books, but I'm interested in an expression of a mind. And that's all art. Art is an expression of a mind. Like, you can't just take the mind out of it.
I don't think that those are equitable examples, though, because a book is written, unless you're Tom Clancy, where you just kind of whistle the plot and someone else writes it for you.
Oh.
A book is written by one person. I can watch a film. In fact, we have watched many of them on this podcast. We can watch a film by someone who is not intelligent, not in touch with their crafts, and the actors involved are. Or there's just a kind of fortuitous fate to that time you turned on the camera.
And that's what allows me in this film to say, Anthony Hopkins is great. Pitt is interesting. I love Tambor. I love that interaction. I don't care about the film, right? Like, I think that's how I end up distinguishing those things, which I think is different for us.
I don't at all. I just don't. I mean, I think the novel thing about this argument is usually we're arguing, we both agree that the film is chaotic and tonally all over the place, and I enjoy that and you don't. This is a new ground for the Pitcast because I just don't think it's chaos. I don't see the chaos. I think it's a lean, successful, tight as a drum, 3-hour movie about death that moves me, that gets me choked up.
It it struck me that watching this film that it would be, I don't know how many people listening to this have watched Mystery Science Theater 3000, which a lot of them are on YouTube, really extraordinary. Shout out to Lucas, who really loves those commentaries. They're basically these old films, some deemed bad films, some not. But what brings them together is these guys having a running commentary track over the film, kind of affectionately making fun of them, or sometimes just straight up making fun of them if they're like cruel films or whatever. But this film struck me as an extraordinary candidate for that, because there are so many silences, so many moments in this film where someone says something to the other person, it's just this long pause, which I actually find quite interesting. That's one of the things I prefer about this film. I prefer a long film that takes its time with conversations, a long film that tries to pack a lot of stuff in. And I think that's good. But it is weird. The tide is a drum thing. I mean, a lot of the scenes are interesting. And I wouldn't want to cut those silences, because they do contribute to the film, ultimately. But baffling decision for the kind of film it is, because it doesn't really give you room to meditate on anything in particular. Like, normally what you want with silence is to kind of feel it as kind of thick or textured, but here it's just waiting.
I don't know if I agree with that, although you saying that does make me think of Too Old to Die Young, the Nicholas Winding Refn Amazon show, which we've mostly referenced people not watching that show, but it's amazing. You watched the first episode, and that show...
I watched the first episode.
That show is like 12 hours long, would be 2 hours long if people spoke at a regular speed.
You can revel in the aesthetics in that show, right? Based on what I saw in the first episode. And there's a tension you could cut with a knife. Whereas Meet Joe Black just doesn't. I never felt tense during the entire film at all. I was not invested in any of the characters in any significant way.
We do have to briefly talk about one of the craziest things that happens in the second half of the film, which is related to what you say. When Pitt and Hopkins are having this back and forth, and Hopkins is pissed off that Pitt, Death, is romantically interested in his daughter, which, I mean, I can empathize with Hopkins. Imagine, you've gone from being
awful.
Oh, my daughter is going to... to marry this kind of dropkick in a bad suit, to my daughter is going to marry Death, the personification
himself,
of death. God damn, talk about kind of out of the frying pan into the fire. I couldn't get much worse than that. There's a scene where they're arguing, and Hopkins, to his credit, is really snapping at Death. He doesn't seem particularly afraid of Death whatsoever. He lets him have it. And Death, as Pitt replies, you know, remember who you're talking to. Remember what I'm capable of doing to you. And it's one of the few moments in the second half of the film that I have this out-of-body experience of going, oh, I'm watching, like, mainstream box office fare starring two of the most famous actors of all time, where one of them is threatening to kill the other because he's not letting him kill his daughter. And in fact, if you notice, what happens in that scene is, like, the very beautiful Thomas Newman score really rises underneath the scene, and it's very light and kind of gentle, I think in an attempt to offset the fact that Pitt is saying, I'll fucking kill you.
Yeah, there's a couple of yelling matches between Hopkins and Pitt, and they're all very exciting and, like, wonderfully played. One thing I kind of like about this film, despite it being 3 hours, is it doesn't fuck around with just getting characters moving in the plot. Like, Hopkins just sees Pitt kiss his daughter, just sees him kiss Susan. So it's like, I saw you kiss her, what's going on? That's the scene. It's like, great, fantastic. I don't want, like, them trying to hide it. And Pitt says something like, I can do what I want, and he says, I'm her father. So there is this kind of quite hilarious thread of kind of paternal, misogynistic permission.
Yes. With Death involved.
With Death. Because that's the thing, is you totally sympathize with Hopkins being mad.
Yes.
And it's like, well, she can do what she wants. She's
yes.
She has agency, but also she probably shouldn't marry Death.
Yes, absolutely.
You don't really need to pull the I'm her father rank.
No, when it's Death. Also, that leads us to talk about the sex scene, which, as I say, is long and well shot, don't you think? It's quite a tender
stately
scene. Yeah.
There's a weird kind of almost photographic shot where it's like a wide shot where they're slightly off center in the frame, and I think Pitt's standing behind her, and then they're like upright after, as they take off each other's clothes. It's very, it doesn't quite feel like it's in a different film, because the stateliness makes sense within this film. It does feel a little like, hey, if you came to see Brad Pitt have sex, we're going to dedicate a few minutes to it.
But very interesting that that hasn't happened really so far. It happens in Thelma and Louise. Why?
And we watched the TV cut of Thelma and Louise, so maybe more explicitly than we saw. That was, we got to revisit Thelma and Louise at some point.
Is Brad Pitt saying, no, I don't want to be naked, I don't want to be the sex object? Not impossibly, given that he's choosing films like California.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely getting scripts across his desk where that is the point, and he isn't doing them, really. It's probably a confluence of his not really wanting to be that kind of person, and also probably just not wanting to do the kind of films that those scenes are in, generally. If you just see the sex scene in this film, and then someone is like, here's the context, you think, well, what the fuck, right? Like, this is not a scene that is necessarily in a film that is as insane as Meet Joe Black.
You speaking of the confluence of kind of factors also makes me think that when you talk about the kind of film he wants to be in, particularly in this era, I think this is Pitt and his management team consciously going for the attention of adults, not horny teenagers who write letters, you know, with a return address to the Brad Pitt fan club and they get a pin in the mail. This is mum and dad. This is respectability. This is, he's not some kind of hot bad boy. You know, if you think about Sleepers, Devil's Own, this, we talked about it before. Those are three films for mum and dad. They're not for kids. And sure, maybe kids will go along with it. It's a little bit like when Robert Pattinson pivoted to the art house just after Twilight. Yeah. And then you had teenagers going to see the film where he plays Salvador Dali and stuff like that, you know?
That's the question, right? If Pitt is coming of age, say, in the 2010s instead of the 90s, is he in A24 films, like, immediately? He does, like, his Thelma and Louise, and then he pivots to kind of interesting mid-tier arty stuff.
Yes, I think
as opposed to these kind of in-between-ish, blockbustery but slightly strange, off-center, maybe multi-star vehicle things.
If you think about, and I'm not saying they're equitable in terms of talent, because I don't, as we know, very much like Timothée Chalamet, but Chalamet and Pitt are kind of similar. They both explode, they're both ex-sex objects, they both kind of immediately clearly want to work in respectable big American movies. And Chalamet, because of social media, I guess, really is part of it. Pitt has to be in movies like Sleepers and Meet Joe Black because there's not Twitter. He needs to stay in the public eye by making a film pretty much every year and making them big, widespread films. And Chalamet can get that kind of attention from wearing an interesting outfit to the Grammys and then make whatever kind of film he wants.
I like the Pattinson comparison as well.
Mm.
As in the, but although Pitt, I think, seems a little more congenial to being a star at this stage. At least, whereas Pattinson seemed to regret signing a contract for three Twilight films pretty soon after starring in the first one.
I like Robert Pattinson. I've always liked Robert Pattinson. Have you ever seen that interview he did where he was promoting Water for Elephants, which is a film all about the circus, and he was on British television, and it was early in the morning, and they asked him some lowball question, and he'd been on the press tour for a while. They said, have you ever been to the circus before? Something stupid like that. And Pattinson went,
didn't he make something up?
Pattinson went, it was very traumatic. I was a kid and I saw a clown die. He was driving around a miniature car and he drove into a wall and died, and it really fucked me up. And the host was like, is that, oh my god. And he was like, yeah, it really was tragic. And then years later he just had to say, I totally made that up. I don't know what was going through my head. We have to stand. As the children say, we simply have to stand. Not the children.
Yeah.
I know many grown-ups who say that too. Well, the only thing we have to say about the sex scene is that immediately after this very tender, handsome sex scene, Susan turns to Pitt and says, was that better than peanut butter? Which is like...
Yeah.
Top 10 moments.
Well, there's another peanut butter callback in that scene where she says it was a slightly syntactically awkward sentence where she says something like, it was like making love to someone when it was their first time or something like that, which is the same as like, it's like you've never had peanut butter before. Like, she's just been like, wow, it seems like you've not experienced these things before, which is very stupid, but also quite sweet.
Very sweet. Maybe in summation, in terms of talking about the actual stuff that happens in the film, we have to talk about this scene where she realizes that he's deaf.
Oh, yeah, I didn't understand that.
Dan's getting a water bottle. I have to point out...
Sorry, I'm back.
Now is a perfect example to point out, Dan is wearing a fantastic shirt today.
Thanks, Joe.
Do you want to describe it?
I can take a shot of it for the Twitter.
Do.
Well, I'm not that good at describing clothes. It's technically a polo shirt, but it has kind of quite like a wide thread. And it's very, Joe, when all this is over, I'll let you feel the material of this shirt. Look forward to that. It's kind of got two parallel patterns running down it, that they're kind of these wide lines that have, I don't know what the technical term for this is, but like the patterns are kind of dotted through the shirt. So it's not like a it's not a pattern that is printed on the shirt. The pattern is only in the thread. And it's kind of what, a foresty green?
It looks, I really like this shirt.
I mean, I tell you, quarantine fashion is weird because you don't have to save shirts for a day when you're about to leave the house or anything. So you can just wear whatever. And you find yourself one day wearing quite a good outfit and the next day wearing garbage. And none of it matters.
I have been quite concerted about making sure that I dress up each day. I've not really schlubbed. Brianna's in the background of the shot. I'm just going to look at her face and see if she's laughing at me. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I'm not listening. I'm writing an angry email.
Oh, she's writing an angry email. Do you think it's true that I've not schlubbed? I've kind of dressed up every day in quarantine?
Dressing up is like a very loose term for you.
Brianna says, dressing up is a loose term for you. What does that mean? I always dress up.
Like, maybe, but something kind of...
What? I hope that Brianna's audio is not really being picked up by the microphone.
I'm picking it up.
She's being rude to me. Maybe I'll cut it out. Brianna was very...
I love you.
I mean, thank you, Brianna. I mean, I haven't said it really on mic. My hair's pink. I dyed my hair pink. I said I was going to. Yeah. We haven't reflected on the fact that it is pink.
It works so well. Joe is also wearing one of his favourite wardrobe items of mine, which is his Kellogg's shirt.
People.
Which is a shirt that has Kellogg's written all over it in a Kellogg's font. It's a red shirt with white writing.
Brianna says that shirt is the world's favourite shirt. It's true.
I mean, it's something I've learned about having a beard of various lengths, to be honest, is that whenever anything is more striking, people will compliment you on it because they will notice it, and the only socially acceptable way of recognising an aesthetic feature of someone is to say it's good, which leaves you kind of like... So when I've had a real... Like, my beard isn't as long as people will tell me they really like it. Or at one point, my hairdresser did my beard in a way where it was quite pointy. Do you remember that? It's like, for a while, it was quite like almost angular at the...
No.
Just, it was just for a couple of weeks and then I took it back. I'm sure we saw each other during that time. Maybe we just didn't. Maybe, I mean, I've had beards of a few different shapes, but a lot of people pointed it out. And I think gradually I realized people didn't like it. I don't even think I liked it. Anyway, that's not to say that your Kellogg's shirt isn't a genuinely great shirt, but obviously it's a shirt that people will recognize and
have something, you know, you've got to say about. It is true, though, that, you know, people who even seem awkward kind of in social encounters will compliment the shirt. So I'll be going through Coles and they'll say nothing, and then at the end they'll kind of blurt out, I like the shirt. It's, there will come a day, Brianna and I were talking about this recently, there will come a day when this Kellogg shirt dies. Some joy will go out of my life and, you know, the life of people around me. I think that's true.
But I guess the only reason I bring up the shirt is because it's in harmony with the pink hair.
Brianna doesn't like red shirt, pink hair. She thinks it doesn't work.
That's interesting. I can't see you in person, which makes it harder to evaluate.
I think it kind of makes me... Brianna's shouting that it's a problem. I think it makes me look like an anime villain. In a good way, not a bad way.
Is there a good way to look like an anime villain?
Yeah.
Is that what we want?
This way. This right here. This is the look. This is the look.
Brianna, do you want to kiss an anime villain, though? I guess that's the question.
No.
Don't listen to her. She's rude. There is a moment where Pitt and Susan are standing across from each other at the party, and it's basically a back and forth series of extreme close-ups on Susan's face and Pitt's face where you see the two looking at each other and something passes between them. You're saying that you interpreted it as her definitely knowing that he's death? I don't think the film commits you to that.
Well, it doesn't. That's what so baffled me. Like, I couldn't work out what else it could be that her revelation is. But, like, she says, you're not the guy from the coffee shop. She seems definitely to realize that he's not the guy from the coffee shop, that he's someone else. I guess the only two realistic possibilities. One is that he is, like, some kind of charlatan who, the guy in the coffee shop wasn't even the guy in the coffee shop, or so he was pretending to be someone else and, like, he's actually, you know, because he looks the same, or that he's his twin. But everything else is supernatural.
I think all she's realized is something funny is going on. I think it's actually handsomely and understatedly and kind of beautifully done, because she has a line where she says something along the lines of, I feel like I'm floating now. She's basically saying, I believe that I'm having an out-of-body experience. Not to invoke him again. But Wittgenstein puts a lot of power in this idea of family resemblances. This phrase, I know it when I see it, Wittgenstein often pins to the idea of family resemblances. That you're seeing something that looks like something else in a way that you can't necessarily specify with words. I think that's kind of the reaction that Susan is meant to be happening. She's just aware that the man that she's standing in front of is slightly more or slightly less than human.
Is there a moment where she starts to say who he is and kind of trails off? Or, I mean, that is plausible. And I quite, like, if the film does that, then I appreciate it. But it's also, is it oddly unsatisfying? I'm not sure.
No, I've already been crying for like half an hour by this point, but I find that terribly moving. Because
it's like, oh, you're someone else. You're some spiritual figure, or like, or just, this isn't what it seems.
This isn't what it seems.
There seems to be some knowledge in her eyes that her father is going to die with that. Like, it's,
yes.
And that seems, like, where does that derive from if she's not realizing that he's deaf?
They've all been worried about his mortality. That's definitely been an undercurrent to the whole film, is that this bizarre behavior that he's been demonstrating towards Joe Black, they are all seeing as a sign of his mortality.
What a strange film.
Dan doesn't like that because it gives too much credence to the film.
Well, no, it not even that. It just doesn't, like, what kind of leaps are we supposed to make, right? Like, I guess so she's, then, but why does she associate the revelation that Brad Pitt is not who she thought he was with her father's impending mortality?
It's just a series of feelings. The dialogue slows right down. There's so much less talking. There's so much more characters watching each other, characters moving from one place to the other. And I think you're only meant to read that as she's getting a sense of something. She's having some kind of emotional response that she's not willing to process.
Sure. That feels real, I guess. I mean, the question I had in the lead up to this film was like, what's going to happen? Like, how does the vocabulary of this film allow for an ending? Like, aha, it's actually death you're marrying. Does death say, well, I'm hanging out on Earth forever, like, I'm giving up on this death game, and just marry her, and they get married, like, they head off into the sunset.
And it does something more intelligent than either of those things.
And I was like, oh, that is what will happen. Like, I did see that coming, because I was like, well, this is the only way they can handle it, surely. So I saw that it would be the coffee shop guy. Or, like, what could happen if she had suddenly revealed to her that he's deaf? Like, what reaction do you have? Like, there's no good way of doing that. So I guess this is how they have to handle it.
And it works.
Sure, why not?
It does work. Do we have any final thoughts, any final things to say about Meet Joe Black?
I feel like I definitely like it more than I sound like I do. It's a it's a film that has some really enjoyable moments. I respect its strangeness. I respect its, this is something I very rarely say about a film. I kind of respect its length. Like, I kind of like a film that, this would be much worse as a 2-hour, yes, isn't a 90-minute film. Like, yes, it wouldn't work. The film works, it needs to be this long to work. I feel like a little bit like Brad Pitt is at a stage now where he's still not sure what he is. Like, maybe more than before. Maybe he's now, like, really, he's got some star power. He's really confronting these questions about what he is as an actor, what he can do, what it means to both maintain his brand and do things that interest him, and kind of wrestle with celebrity. And I think this film is kind of an interesting inflection point in that journey.
Context is important, right? After this, he works with Fincher again, and he makes Fight Club. Maybe his best known film that he's in, maybe?
Yeah, which is weird, right? Because it feels like it's subverting the image of Brad Pitt in a way, or like playing, riffing on it. But Fight Club's got to be better known than Seven, right? Like,
interesting, given that when it was first released, it was not well received at all. I'm glad for a lot of reasons that we're doing a non-Pitt next week, but I think we need to take a breath to prepare to talk about Fight Club. I don't know how we're going to do that. What do you say? Yeah. What do you say that's not been said 60,000 times before?
Well, what we say is what we say after watching like 20 other Brad Pitt films. That's our difference.
That's our point of difference. We're going to, of course, do the Letterboxd game. In the Letterboxd game, I will reveal my own, of course, very exciting score.
We love that.
Before we do that, despite often plugging the Pittcast Gmail, I in particular have been kind of neglecting it a little bit. I haven't been dipping back into the inbox as much as I should. It's now set up to come straight to my phone. So I'm going to do...
Yeah, me too. Fantastic.
I'm going to do my radio thing. Are you ready? Imagine that you're tuned into my radio show, This Is a Love Song, 11 p.m. on FBI Radio on a Sunday. This is how I spruik the text line. I'm now going to spruik it for the Pittcast. My voice is slightly different on the radio show, so I'm going to try and do that voice. Actually, I can't. Now I'm freaking out. Now I've scared myself.
It's just a little more sultry, right?
I feel anxious. Okay, I'm gonna give it a try. I'd love to hear from you here at the Pitcast. Dan and I would love you to get in touch. We'd particularly love you to get in touch via our email. That's a really direct way to talk to us. The email is thebradpitcast@gmail.com. Now, in terms of what we're looking for, tell us anything. Ask us questions. Talk to us. Share something with us. Ask us something specific about maybe something that we've brought up in the past. But please do email us, thebradpitcast@gmail.com. Pull out your phone right now. Tap that into the to box. Give it whatever subject you want. And excitingly, we will read out your email on the show. All right.
Luring.
Deranged Joe is back. Hey, hey, fucking
Joe. I love that slightly more chaotic energy during our daytime Brad Pitcast recordings than your 11 p.m.
Yes.
Radio show.
Yeah. We will email us and we'll read out your email.
Something that's happening to me is I'm flipping windows to look at the email that we're about to read. And so I'm going into my desktop. And what Zoom does, we're obviously talking on Zoom at the moment, is it just, instead of showing me the video of you in the top right of my screen, it just shows me the video of me. And I don't want that. Is there a way around that?
I don't know. Zoom is very confusing to me most of the time.
Like, I want to see you in the corner. Why am I looking at me? That's much less interesting anyway.
We would love you to email us. We would love you to email us with any questions that you may have. We will read them out and we will address them on the show. So now is a perfect time for any burning questions that you may have had regarding literally anything that we've ever said or done. That's the way to do it. We have a platonic example of one of these emails.
I will say this is a dear friend of mine whose email I will check the email occasionally. I straight up missed this one. I don't know how that happened. It's from my friend Will. We went to high school together, actually. He's a wonderful man. We should look. It's a long email, and we might pick out. It's a glorious email, but we might pick out a few key questions from it, which are questions that could fuel probably hours and hours of Pitcast, so we might return to them.
A really interesting note included in here is that apparently people used to call you Dixon at high school. Is that correct?
Exclusively. When I was in grade 3, I think there were 4 Daniels in my class and another one in my grade. So there happened to be 4 Daniels in the same class. That is something that plagued me throughout school. There were at least 4 in my high school year. So most of them had nicknames, and I was Dixon. And I still have a couple of friends from high school who call me Dixon. Most of my high school friends call me Dixon.
Does anyone make Mason Dixon line jokes?
No, they weren't that sophisticated.
No fans of American Geography?
No, American, Civil War.
We'll rewatch Thelma and Louise with our quite critical and, as we've said before, very bad episode of this podcast ringing in his ears. Our most chaotic episode. When I reflect on that period of time, I feel like I'm reflecting on the actions of another person. That night, we both kind of just went mad. Very hard to explain.
I haven't re-listened to it in full. I couldn't bring myself to. Too strange.
It's very strange. We'll rewatch that film. Despite our criticisms, well, not despite, people can rewatch whatever they like. And he said that he felt that the film could be classified in the same general ballpark as these films, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Breakfast Club, and maybe like Clerks. I think that's an astute observation. I think it's particularly astute because I hate every one of those films. Maybe more than I hate Thelma and Louise. I really hate those movies.
Well, I've seen Clerks and Ferris Bueller. I have not seen The Breakfast Club, but I know about The Breakfast Club. One thing I will say about all those films is they are all about people, and as a Thelma and Louise, people stuck in drudgery who subvert that drudgery.
Yes.
Right? They all operate within that kind of thread of the American dream, where there is the failed image of the American dream, where it reveals the labor that is operating behind that fantasy, and then show the things that individuals can do to subvert that, you know, exploitation, find something akin to the fantasy for a brief moment of time.
I guess so. I guess
they all do that?
I think they definitely do that. I just,
I'm not saying that's good.
No.
I'm just saying they all do that.
I guess that's a more intelligent reading. I just hate those movies. I
like Ferris Bueller. I think it's fun.
Two of them were written by John Hughes, who I think is one of the worst American artists that to ever be involved in cinema. I hate all of his movies. They're ugly and weird. Probably the best movie that he ever wrote was Home Alone 2, I think. We sometimes talk about this American vernacular of kind of cinema that, or even television, that we find not funny and off-putting. And the example that we use is Saturday Night Live. I would put John Hughes movies in that same category.
I still think Ferris Bueller is, like, it captures the sense of day offness that it's going for in quite a wonderful way, I think.
It captures the sense of day offness, Dan.
Quarantine is turning my brain to garbage.
I mean, it's true. It's just that's so much more generous than you are to meet Joe Black. You would never say meet Joe Black catches the sense of Joe Blackness. Like...
Film while I can.
I know, we all are. Will's next point is, Pitt's role in Thelma and Louise seems to have inspired Ethan Hawke's look in every single film he's ever been in, perhaps.
I love that too.
I had not considered the Pitt-Hawke connection. Are they very similar? Maybe they're aesthetically...
Well, could Pitt be cast as basically every Hawke role? He could be in First Reformed. He could definitely be in Before Sunrise.
Oh, I mean, Pitt in First Reformed is... That's a wild thing to consider.
But absolutely, like, Southern Preacher, sign me up.
Yeah, like, he could definitely do it. Oh, that's... They should just do a shot by shot.
They'd be different films, right? I guess that's what I'm saying. It's like, people would be a different character, but he could be a religious figure in a church in that with that same script, basically.
He could
be in Before Sunrise. It would be... He'd be more of a jock, but it would be fine. It would still work.
He could so be the deadbeat dad in Richard Linklater's Boyhood. Yeah, I think they're an interesting comparison. I think they both have a slight shit-kicker quality, but there's maybe something about Hawke that you can use in a kind of more... He seems like more of a threat than Pitt. Pitt kind of never really plays a threat, and Hawke you can use in a number of different ways. He can come across as a little bit slimy and a little bit cruel in a way that Pitt tried to do in California and was not successful with.
Pitt has a much nicer smile, and a much more... Hawke's smile is like a little bit, there's something behind it, you know? You're not sure if it's authenticity, but...
Sometimes when Hawke smiles and it's inauthentic, it's because he's trying to trick you, and sometimes it's because he's haunted, and the smile is a kind of plaster front on top of decay, basically. I really like Ethan Hawke. I mean, Oscar talk is always disappointing, but the fact that he didn't get nominated for First Reformed is just... I mean, every year something happens that makes you say, what is the point of the Oscars? But genuinely, what is the point of the Oscars if they don't recognize work like that? But there were few better performances that year.
It was really good. I'm not even sure I don't think I like the film as much as you. I saw it once. I still don't know how I felt about it. It shook me up a lot. But I would acknowledge that Hawke's performance was virtuosic.
Let's speed through these last questions. They're all very good questions. Do you think Anthony Lane is a good critic? Is Will's next question. Anthony Lane of The New Yorker. He's been around for a very long time, Lane.
Yeah, decades, I think.
He famously, I think we have brought him up on this show, right? Because we talked about him getting very horny for Mrs. Incredible, which he did
in his
Incredibles 2 review. I don't like or trust most American critics.
I mean, I'm obviously not as integrated into the world of film critics as you are. Anthony Lane and Adam Gopnik is another one. There's a few writers at The New Yorker who have this slightly kind of lightweight, like faux lightweight style. Like, they're obviously very intelligent. They obviously know a lot. But it's if they try to write prose as if they were kind of skipping through fields while writing it, and it kind of drives me insane. I think something I believe, and I've probably made jokes in some stuff I've written, but I think broadly, if you're a professional comedy writer, don't make jokes in writing. I just don't want to hear it. That's not what I'm there for. If you're like, obviously that's not universal rule. This is a really like a widespread illness in the Australian media set. This kind of press gallery, foppish, joking, like, aren't we all having fun style of writing that I find totally insufferable. And I think Anthony Lane, while at points is a really astute critic, feels obliged to thread his prose with that kind of thing, and it just drives me a bit mad.
I should probably clarify I don't like most American critics. I think, again...
Some might listen.
Yeah, I know, some might listen. Here are the American critics I like. I really like David Sims of The Atlantic. He's also a co-host of Blank Check, a podcast that I really like. But his writing is sharp and astute and always interesting. I really like Kay Austin Collins, also really excellent. I always enjoy reading Richard Brody.
A good maniac.
A wonderful maniac, an important maniac. And I really enjoy
reading, and his name has gone clean out of my head.
What press?
He blocked me on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Contrary. Armand White?
Armand White. And Manola Dargis. Those are the critics that I like, and I like those critics because they are the critics that resist. Last time I referred to him, I called him frequent punching bag of this podcast. The Roger Ebert effect of film criticism being the evaluative process of going thumbs up or thumbs down, garbage, garbage. Any critic who thinks that their job is to say whether a film is good or bad has misunderstood what it means to be a critic. When I read...
I'm not going to choose this moment to talk to you about your obsession with Letterboxd ratings, but we can...
Shut up, Dan. Deal with that later. But I like the Letterboxd rating because it's an indicative of a generalized taste. A critic tries to not do that. Most of these critics kind of try and fold in with the pack with each other and form this establishment. It's not what I'm interested in. There are many critics who I don't agree with and I constantly clash with, and I mean, I don't know them. I'm not talking about conversationally. I mean, they'll dismiss a film that I'll really like and vice versa. I don't care about that. If they have given me something to chew on, if we're having a discussion, too many American critics fall into this idea that their job is like to be Peter Travers and to give like a quote for the poster, a pull quote that's like, this year's most entertaining, blah, blah, blah. And it's not. You're meant to make me enter into conversation with you and the film in an interesting way.
I could not agree with you more. I think everything you've said is correct. Apart from the disliking American critics, I don't read enough to be able to make that kind of statement. I do like A.O. Scott, I have to say. I think he writes very well and is really smart. Yeah, Will said about Anthony Lane, he doesn't really make the more interesting interpretive leaps than Richard Brody does. And I think that is extremely true.
I think that's very true. Will also says, Brad Pitt seems to be a more compelling American object than Owen Wilson, but why? I think it's because Wilson is the same kind of American object every single time. A Owen Wilson podcast would get... You'd be having the same conversations every single time, both because of the way that movies use him and just because of fundamentally who he is. I mean, he's been in varied stuff, but if you were doing a podcast about Owen Wilson, you'd have to not talk about Owen Wilson most of the time.
Well, it's interesting because this email was sent before we tweeted out the video of Brad Pitt in the Wes Anderson ad for SoftBank. Owen Wilson, obviously a recurrent figure in Wes Anderson films. Brad Pitt, you can imagine playing... I mean, I'm just... Like, it's funny now. Now I start to say this, I'm starting to list in my mind a bunch of Wes Anderson characters that you can imagine Brad Pitt playing with. Like, you can imagine Brad Pitt playing both the Bill Murray and the Jason Schwartzman roles in Rushmore.
Yes.
And doing it quite well.
Yes.
And it would obviously be very different, but both would be... He could absolutely... Maybe he'd have a bit more trouble with Jason Schwartzman, but he could still do it.
No, he could do it. He could definitely
and that's not to say, like, he's a far better actor than Owen Wilson or anything, although he probably is.
He definitely
He just does, as you say, have that versatility of... He always brings a set of features to a role, like a physicality, a shit kicker, which Owen Wilson also has that kind of shit kicker vibe, as you say. But I don't know.
It's
just not seeing Wilson bring anything new to anything.
No. What do we talk about when we talk about Owen Wilson? We talk about kind of a murmuring, a wow, these vocal affects, things to do with his voice that doesn't change whether he's in that fucking weirdo movie that's an ad for Google or if he's in the Haunting of Hill House remake that he was in. Whereas what do we talk about when we talk about Brad Pitt? I don't know. I mean, we talk about a kind of florid, baroque, kind of ornamental style, but those are vaguer words for a reason. It's harder to say what makes Brad Pitt who he is than what makes Owen Wilson who he is.
Owen Wilson's charisma is definitely there, and I like Owen Wilson, but he doesn't seem inexpressible in the same way Pitt does. He doesn't seem uncapturable.
No. Which is interesting because, I mean, I'm thinking of the Darjeeling Limited, which is a film that was written in the aftermath of obviously a very distressing period in Owen Wilson's life, and explains that very distressing period of his life, but in a way that makes him very graspable, versus Brad Pitt being in something like By the Sea, which is a film that references a couple's life together and is made by that couple, but makes Pitt and Jolie more ephemeral, not easier to understand, harder to understand.
It's the Bob Dylan of it all. Give people enormous amounts of information and that they don't actually know who you are. This just occurred to me. I was thinking about the fact that it's quite easy to do an Owen Wilson impression. Has anyone ever done a Brad Pitt impression? What would that even look like?
I'm a little taken aback. I don't know what it looks like. I guess these days, because it's kind of the shorthand for Pitt, it would be eating. You'd be eating a lot and you'd be chewing and you'd do that kind of cud movement with your lower jaw. It would have to be stuff like that. But if I tried to do Jimmy Stewart or Arnold Schwarzenegger right now, it wouldn't need any context clues. But if I just started eating and like licking my fingers, you'd be like, fucking Winnie the Pooh. Like, you would require
even Owen Wilson, right?
Yeah,
you can say a single word. I could do Schwarzman. I could do Bill Murray. I could do Tom Cruise. People have done right. The kind of energy. You think about other big American stars.
Yeah,
but no one does Brad Pitt. I think some people would say it's because he doesn't have enough, I don't know, tech, like meat to him or something, but I don't think that's right.
No, because you know it when you see it. It's family relations. Yeah. You always know that it's him, but you just can't speak about it in the abstract as effectively. Which should be, I mean, we keep talking about who we're going to do when we're done with Pitt, not because we're excited about being done with Pitt, but I think more because it's interesting to think about what makes him different and what makes him similar. And it's why I think someone like Cameron Diaz... Also, what does a Cameron Diaz impression look like? Even though she's everywhere and most people would know that name. What does it look like?
I have no idea. And I can feel like there are a lot of comparable actors. Again,
it's very interesting. Who are impressionable.
Impressionistic.
Two more points to pull out of Will's extremely lovely and exciting email. He has this line, which I think is interesting. I sometimes have a cynical belief that what constitutes artistic taste is always an expression about the things about oneself that one finds attractive. I think what Will's talking about is the way that art can kind of be tribal, that, you know, you are drawn to people who like the things that you like because it speaks to some kind of values that you either see in yourself or, I think, kind of the step further from what Will's saying, sometimes art is about, it's aspirational. It's not the things that you see in yourself that you like, it's the ways that you wish you were that you would like.
Yeah.
I think that's a really key part of it.
It's always been one of the things I appreciate about visual art and painting in particular, because I have no sense of visual creativity. Like, I'm unable to put a pencil to paper, never been able to, it's never been something I've wanted to do. And I feel like it's one of the few areas of artistic experience where I can just be totally immersed in it without feeling like I wish I had done this or I wish I could do this, because I don't. Like, it doesn't, I don't want to do that. But obviously reading, I feel like part of the, any kind of awe I feel is like a little entangled with jealousy often, or at least a incomprehension, like how could someone do this, I wish I could. So I think there is something like that. So I guess that's where the aspirational thing comes into it, which is a combination of I feel like I have the potential to do this and I haven't been given the space to flourish.
Last point that Will makes. I can't wait until you get to Burn After Reading, which, like Dan, I think is probably Pitt's best role. Booked in a guest for that episode this very week. It's a long way away, but we had a guest, a very exciting guest, who was very excited to do that film. I think a lot of people are looking forward to that episode. So I'm very excited that we have the guest that we have. Other Pitt films that Will looks forward to hearing about, and this speaks to, you know, getting a sense, I don't know Will really at all, but the fact that he's excited about these films gives me some sense of who he is. Will says he's excited for Troy, fucking, you know, looming in our horizon very soon. Oceans 11 to 13, we have a guest for Oceans 11, very excitingly. The Big Short, I hate that film, Dan quite likes it, we'll see how that one goes. And War Machine, which is bonkers, which I think we have a chance of getting the director of that film on this podcast.
Okay. God, you're putting that on the record.
I sort of know him, and I sort of know people who know him, and I know very well some people who have worked on projects with him. He went to my high school.
Have we said anything negative about War Machine on the podcast?
Yeah, yes. So.
I've never seen it.
I mean, I've probably said some negative things, but I don't know what he'd say. You know who it is who directed it, right? It's Michaud. It's Animal Kingdom. Dave Michaud. Oh,
I love Animal Kingdom.
I mean, we'll butter him up with that and we'll see how we go. Him and Andrew Dominik, director of Killing Them Softly, these are people that, like, are graspable.
I mean, let's put things in order. Hubris, but why not?
Why not?
Also, you might be listening to this in 10 years and we're still grappling with the pandemic, but who knows, at the moment, who knows how long it will last. Hopefully these people will be sitting at home waiting for a phone call. They're not making movies.
No, exactly. They're ready for us. Letterbox game.
Just thank you so much, Will. Again, if you want to us to answer your questions, we would love to hear them. thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
Oh, related, rate and review The Brad Pitt Cast on iTunes, which I believe is the only place that you can give a rate and review. Here is a deal. Rate, review, leave a review. In a couple of weeks, maybe we'll give a time period of about 3 weeks. Leave a review. We will assess all of the reviews. The best review, and best is however you like, the review that most clearly indicates like deep insider knowledge of the podcast, or it's just very funny, or it's just very chaotic.
But it has to be 5 stars, probably. Are we allowed to say that?
I mean, no, I don't think we are. Obviously. But, you know, if it's in an you imploring Dan to get an earring, these are qualities that would make a good podcast review. We will choose the best one. We will ask that person to come forward because their username won't necessarily be visible. And that person will choose our non-Pitcast film. So if you have been dying to hear us talk about some kind of movie that does not feature Brad Pitt, the opportunity will be yours if you leave an iTunes rating and review. And the review is creative and interesting. Here are the two reviews we have. One from JimmyBill92, amazing username, fantastic, fun, and interesting. Another one from Bruns Pitt, yes, and then nice, !! I love that second one. I love them both.
That's good, yeah.
Leave a review, and you could win the opportunity to make us talk about literally fucking whatever.
As long as I'm going to veto certain, like, I don't want to watch Solo or whatever, you know.
What? Why don't you watch Solo? Whoever, okay, someone should now try and win and make Dan watch Solo. I'm all for it. My Criterion Collection copy of Solo is right over there.
I don't, just nothing too upsetting.
Solo isn't that upsetting.
Really? Isn't it known for being upsetting?
I mean, sure, yeah, but it's not. They're wrong.
Okay.
I promise you would not find it so upsetting. I absolutely promise. Some reviews. We're doing a positive one first. Letterboxd reviews. What would I do without the Letterboxd game? I'm just going to read you this one because the person doesn't have a top 4 films.
Wonderful.
5 stars. Favorite movie of all time. That's the whole review. Oh, amazing. Here we go. Oh, I love this game. This person has only rated 12 films. They've only given stars to 12 films. They've never given anything under 4 stars. So they obviously just came to this app and they were like, I'm going to, you know, rate all of my favorite films. Those films include the Harry Potter movies, which they've given like 5 stars, 4.5 stars. Indiana Jones, 4.5 stars, 5 stars. Coherence. Have you seen that film? It's a Primer-like, very low-budget film about parallel universes. I don't like it very much, but a lot of people like it. Anyway, so...
A wonderful outlier in this
example. Total chaos. Here's the review. I loved this so much. It didn't feel like 3 hours at all. Anthony Hopkins and Brad Pitt are amazing together. We agree on that, don't we?
Definitely.
The humor scattered throughout is great, and the ending was done very well to draw on the emotional attachment you have to the characters. Yes! Yes! Easily one of, if not, the best movies I've ever seen. Oh, I love it. Fascinating. I love it. All right. We'll do 1 5-star, then we'll do a 1-star, and then we'll end with another 5-star. Okay, here we go. Top 4 films. This is a person without a profile picture, which, as I've said many times before, it's the way to my heart. It's not having a profile picture because it means that you've got some chaos energy going on.
Top four
films. Nora Ephron's Julie and Julia. Have you seen that film?
Oh, okay. I have not.
The cooking
about
film.
About cooking.
Yes. About the blogger who recreates all of Julia Child's recipes. Starring one of my least favorite actors, Meryl Streep.
We're not doing a Meryl Streep cast anytime soon.
I fucking hate her. I think she's always bad.
Okay. No comment.
Dan doesn't want to get involved, I can see. Annihilation. I really like that movie.
Great soundtrack, fun film.
Unbelievable soundtrack. Moulin Rouge, Baz Luhrmann's probably second worst film. And Midsommar, 21st century masterpiece.
Good film.
I don't think a movie has broken my heart like this in a long time. I read some reviews and what people seem not to like is that it's almost 3 hours long and slow in parts, but it went by in a blink for me. I could have watched this movie for 6 hours. Me too. Me too. All right, we're going to quickly do a very low rating one and then we'll end on a high. Oh, here we go. I mean, this person only has three favorites. They don't count. I'm just going to blitz through them. Their three favorites are Fight Club, Dark Knight, and Inception. So that gives you a good sense of what we're dealing
dorm
with.
Dorm room.
Yes. 3 hours of my life gone, wasted, just to see some chick having sex with death. Outrageous. I like that that implies that he was aware that Susan sleeps with death. Yeah. And he was like, I'm going right in. Here we go. Matt Goldberg, top four films. The Graduate, one of your all-time favorites.
One of my favorite films. Yeah, I think that's a masterpiece, total masterpiece. Dustin Hoffman is impeccable. It's got basically every single line is hilarious. I love that film.
Yeah, I quite like, I think it's a pretty good movie with an unbelievable ending. I think that ending is genius.
The story is right that Mike Nichols was yelling at them during that, right? And they didn't really know what to do.
Is that correct?
I think he was like abusing them. Yeah.
Really? He was like very angry.
I think so. I don't know if he was like doing it to get an effect. I assume so because Mike Nichols, by all reports, is like a sweet guy. But,
great filmmaker. I love Nichols. I really like Nichols.
Yeah, incredible.
You know, he was an improv.
I think there was like that was on set. That was like a. I can't remember. So I read that once.
Huh.
That they were being like yelled at.
You know, Nichols and Elaine May were improv partners. Very famous. Like,
yeah, Nichols and May.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I've never delved that much into it, but I've really wanted to.
Have you seen many Elaine May films, or have you just seen Mikey and Nikki?
Just seen Mikey and Nikki. What else should I watch?
Oh, you'd love A New Leaf. That stars her. It stars her and Walter Matthau. She's unbelievable in that film. It's excellent. Other favourites. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I love that film.
Never seen it. My father had the record of the soundtrack, and that is inscribed on my soul, but I've never seen the film.
Ennio Morricone, that... Ooh, The Fountain, the Darren Aronofsky film. Have you seen it?
I have not.
Darren Aronofsky is a big, dumb baby. And
a lunatic.
His movies... No, not a lunatic. Lunatic sounds like a chaotic genius. He's a big, dumb baby. Sometimes his movies are good because they're movies made by a big dumb baby. But when he thinks he's like mad possessed genius, they're bad. So Fountain is a bad film because he thinks that he's being very smart. He is unfortunately a big dumb baby. The Wrestler, good film because it's made by a big dumb baby. And Noah, probably his best film starring Russell Crowe because that's a big dumb baby movie. But
Mother is a bad film?
I saw it in the cinema.
I couldn't work it out.
No, I don't know. There's no film that I'm unable to speak authoritatively on, as is the case of Mother. I mean, big dumb baby movie, right?
Definitely. Big dumb baby energy.
Yeah, massive big dumb baby energy, but maybe good. The kind of societal...
I couldn't work it out.
The societal breakdown that movie does kind of towards the end... probably pretty good, but lots of big dumb baby energy. And fourth favorite film, one of my least favorite films of all time, Robert Zemeckis's Back to the Future. Hate that movie. I don't think it's fun at all.
It's ugly.
Matt Goldberg's review. I know this movie has its defenders, but I thought it was fucking abysmal. If you told me Martin Brest had never directed a movie before, I'd believe you. If you told me this film had no editors, I'd believe you. The film moves at a glacial pace, believing its every moment to be deeply profound instead of a cascade of poor decisions like Pitt's detached performance or casting a total dud like Fulani or pretending there's any chemistry between the two or wasting loads of time on what will happen to a disgustingly wealthy person's business.
I just want to say he might be right about the lack of chemistry between Pitt and
Fulani. No.
Okay.
No, I mean, you can express that point of view, of course, but I just don't see it. Oh, here we go. Mwah. What a review to end on. I'm so excited. Sometimes the Letterboxd gods just kind of place the right review in your hands at the right time. Top four films are insane. Alfred Hitchcock's To Catch a Thief.
I love that film.
Yeah, I like that film too. The Pink Panther.
Wow. I watched that a bunch as a kid, thought it was pretty funny.
I watched it as a kid too, and I was really confused by the ending. I had like a Planet of the Apes, like that comedian we talked about who saw Planet of the Apes and was like, wow, yeah. the apes have a Statue of Liberty too. I was like, wow, Inspector Clouseau was the bad guy all along, because they frame him at the end.
Oh, funny.
And I was just a dumbass kid, and I don't remember.
It's been too long since I've seen it, but I definitely liked it. And again, great soundtrack, great score.
I think Brianna is coming down to ask me a question. She says no, she's not. My cousin...
Leave that in.
My cousin Vinny.
Never seen it.
Never seen it either. Ready Player One.
Maybe the worst film of all time.
Maybe the worst film ever time. Yeah, I tell you something, I can see this person's recent activity. Their last... Look, you can see their last four films. Do you see what they are?
It's the Hunger Games, right?
It's Hunger Games, then Ready Player One, Ready Player One, Ready Player One. They rewatched it three times, one after the other, and gave it 5 stars each time. But this is a 5-star review of Meet Joe Black. Fused with graceful suspense and passion, the film's duality between the known and the unknown navigates the inner workings of love and identity. Brad Pitt as Joe Black lends an idiosyncratic portrayal to death, reserved and mysterious when with Susan Parrish, arrogant with Bill Parrish, and intimidating when confronting Drew. Yet his soft-spoken, mild-mannered appeal fits perfectly with the gravitas of the length of the film. Director Martin Brest emphasizes that life takes time, and we feel that with all of life's emotion. Are you ready for this last sentence? I hope so.
Can't wait.
Set aside the 3 hours to meet Joe Black, and you will walk away having lived a little more.
I hope that person's okay.
They're right. They're correct, Dan. You do have... Do you not feel like you've lived a little more?
I mean, in terms of time, yes.
You've just kind of passed more through the world.
Uh-huh.
Great film. I'm so glad that we talked about it. I didn't tell you my own rating. What do you think I gave this film?
4.5 stars.
Yes, I did.
Great. I would give it 3.
It's
a 3-star film. Which, when you give a film 4.5 stars and I give a film 3 stars, I end up sounding like I'm talking about a 1-star film and you end up sounding like you're talking about a 5-star film. Which is, I guess, interesting. It makes things, keeps things interesting. But yeah, I didn't hate this. We went on a journey. I've spent a number of hours of my life dedicated to this film now.
You know, I've watched a couple of thousand films according to Letterboxd. Do you know how many I've given 4.5 stars?
80.
250.
Okay.
But still, a small percentile.
It's a relatively small percentage.
Next.
It's in the top tier.
Do you know...
I was also, by the way, I said 80 because I was assuming there's like another set of 5-star films. So I was assuming you'd give more 5 stars. Anyway.
No, how many 5 stars did I give? 90. Next week, we will be talking about one of those 90 films. We will be talking about a film that I have already started rewatching in preparation to rewatch like a whole bunch of times.
Nixon.
Directed by
Oliver Stone.
Starring
Anthony Hopkins.
Hopkins. We're going from Hopkins to Hopkins. We're doing two American epics.
I second guessed myself because I thought I wound up. I was just thinking about Meet Joe Black, but yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, it will be very exciting. It will be a scary episode for me because I'm worried that Dan won't like one of the best films ever made. But you know, we'll see. Do you know who plays Henry Kissinger in Oliver Stone's Nixon?
No.
Paul Sorvino.
Oh.
Do you know, from Goodfellas, Dan. It's so good. We don't often do this. I think listeners of the Pitcast often don't come to the podcast necessarily always having watched the film. Watch Nixon. It's like 3.5 hours. It'll fly by. You'll have the best time. Watch, if you can, listeners of the Pitcast, watch the 3.5 hours extended edition. That's the one that we'll be talking about and that Dan will drag himself through. Dan, it clips by. Park out an evening and just like, bam, 3.5 hours of Paul Sorvino doing a very weird Henry Kissinger voice. You'll have so much fun. It's so much fun. It's basically a 3.5 hour episode of The Larry Sanders Show.
Oh, that's a way to get me on board.
Yeah, it really is. You'll have a delight, a scream. Till then, email us.
TheBradPitcast@gmail.com.
Leave a review.
iTunes.
Best review wins the ability to tell us what film we're going to do. And start thinking about which film you'd want us to do.
Thank you so much, everyone, for sticking through us through Meet Joe Black. Take care.
Not
we love you.
Not sticking through.
strike that from the record. Thank you for delighting in the joy of Meet Joe Black over almost 3 hours of podcast to match the almost 3 hours of movie. We love you.
We'll see you next week.
See you next week.